Tip Today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. Your Peugeot car or van might benefit from a free software upgrade. For more information and to find out if this applies to your vehicle, call the lads in Slattery's Garage, puck on 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.
Welcome back to Tip Today. Brian was in touch with us. He said, I'm not a farmer. I think Thomas's analysis of Russian interference in the farmers' protests is propaganda being peddled by Europe to discredit their cause. The lack of coverage in our and European media is also deliberate. It's trying to play down the impact of the marches and to quell support for the farmers. They should be supported in their just cause against globalist capitalists taking farming through legislation. That's from Brian. Tend to agree with you on that, Brian. Another listener says, why were the migrants moved out of the Dublin Centre for the weekend, then moved back? Was it for the St. Patrick's Day parade? And how much did it cost the taxpayer? Keep those texts coming into us, 083 311 3311 or 1800 938 007.
Legal discussion on Tip Today is brought to you in association with Lynch Solicitors Clonmel, on the web at lynchsolicitors.ie and at divorceinireland.com.
And our legal eagle, John Lynch from Lynch Solicitors, joins us in studio this morning. Good morning, John.
Good morning. How are you, Alison?
I'm good. We're going to continue that discussion on employer liability.
Yeah, I started this last week and went through a couple of cases with Fran. I got sidetracked, actually, during the week because I was trying to do a checklist for making a will. And I, just as a total aside, people are always asking, how much does it cost to make a will? And I handed the checklist to somebody in the office and it went to 15 pages of things you have to check. And their comment was, well, now you don't really think we can cover all these things for 100 euro or 150 euros or whatever. And I said, yeah, but it really is interesting because your responsibility as a lawyer when you're making a will to ensure that everything is right, there are so many aspects to it. And it was only when I sat down and looked at it that I realised all the different avenues you have to explore. Mm. I mean, down to the status, somebody's status, you know, were you ever married? Were you ever in a relationship? You know, were you divorced? You know, all of those things that you actually have to investigate in order to ensure that you're properly advising somebody. Anyway, that was an aside, a total aside.
Can I ask you, actually, given the results of the referendum has now, you know, it's finished, we know what way that that went. Had you concerns about that? Because there were concerns expressed about how it would affect succession and things like that. Did you share those concerns?
Well, I did a slot with you on it.
Yeah.
And I read, basically at the time, I offered the opinion that the referendum, the clauses that were already in the Constitution were being replaced by, the first one, which is the family referendum, was being replaced by extending the definition of family within our Constitution, which is our kind of a legal Bible that covers how we do and make up our legal system and our rules within the system. And basically I said that was down to whether or not you felt that that should be expanded or not. And obviously if it does get expanded, and which it didn't, it would raise issues on succession and it would raise all of the various issues. And I suppose it's probably easy for me to say now that, or easier for me to say now that all of the elements of it weren't properly discussed within our legislators who put this before us for decision. And I think it's an interesting one because I've been involved in a couple of referendum discussions and presentations right back to the Right to Life amendment to the Constitution. And I remember at the time when I did that one, I remember I was a young fella at the time, not that I hope I'm not too old now, but I was very much of a newbie in law. I was just qualified and I was asked to give a talk in Sligo before a very esteemed group. And I offered the opinion on my analysis of the case law that I didn't consider that it was necessary to amend the Constitution, and that I said that I felt that it wouldn't add a significant amount to our, that famous term, jurisprudence. And funny, when you looked at the constitutional amendment that was being proposed in the context of the woman's place in the home and the misunderstanding or misreading of that, almost to the extent of saying, you know, people suggesting that that particular clause in the Constitution said that that's where you should be if you were a woman, which it isn't. But the interesting counter question on it was whether or not it had done anything over the years. You know, the fact of the matter was the clause on my reading of it simply said that we should be trying to protect somebody's decision to stay within the family unit. And it does raise the question, has that ever materialised? Mm. Which of course leads you right back in a full circle then to, you know, why, and if you are going to change and you're going to put something else that says instead of endeavour, strive, which effectively waters down even what was there, what were we doing it for? Mm. And I suppose at the end of the day, that's what most people kind of seem to have said, you know, what are we doing this for? What's it going to do? We don't know what it's going to do. So why would we change it? So yeah, it'd be very interesting to see will they revisit it.
Yeah, it will. Back now to employer liability.
Yes, back to
liability.
What we're supposed to be talking about. Now, there was a couple of cases we were talking about. And basically, employer liability, it kind of breaks into two categories. There's what we call the common law and then there's the statute law. Now, the statute law, or the law that was brought in through Europe on safety at work, is kind of the primary one that you're looking at now in this day and age, because it's a huge body of rules that have been imposed is the wrong word, but have been implemented within the system of health and safety and in the context of health and safety. And I think a lot of the case law that you might look at historically has to be looked at in that context. You know, in other words, the common law duty simply said to try and do the best you could, whereas the current rule is, you know, do as much as practicable in the circumstances, or practical in the circumstances, and it's a higher benchmark, you know. And when we were looking at it, we were talking about, like last week we talked about the case where the fella put a surface over a counter, covered a hole in the counter and then stepped into the hole. And Fran was very exercised by the fact that if you stepped into the hole, why in the name of God could you possibly succeed? And then that led into a discussion. I said to him that it was a question of contributory negligence, and I think he put another word on it, that it was more in the realm of quite a daft thing to do, to be stepping into the hole. But anyway, but the interesting thing about it is, you know, I mean, the obligation of the employer to the employee under health and safety, I mean, one of the primary or interesting examples is that if, as an employer, you do something, you say to somebody, look, here's a dangerous situation, here's how you protect yourself. And the particular example that I'll give you is Dublin Bus. And funny, because I was in Dublin over the weekend and I did observe how threatening it can be. And now, whether it's to do with Fitzpatrick's weekend or not, I'm not sure, but how threatened a driver in a bus could be by people who are over the limit in terms of alcohol, but maybe, and arriving, getting onto the bus, and, you know, the responsibility. Where is the line of responsibility by the employer in that situation? And it actually came up in a case in last year where an employee of Dublin Bus, sitting inside at, you know, the driver's seat, somebody arrives in with a syringe and attacks him and basically stabs him with the syringe, and he sues his employer. And the employer came back with, well, we put up a safety barrier, because you see it when you come onto the buses. Yeah. We put up a safety barrier, and that's fine. You know, we have to treat our, like, one of the things that we have to treat our employers as adults, and therefore we can't be constantly remind them of their safety. Because in this particular situation, what the driver did was because he said that you couldn't hear passengers, he used to lift it, and then wouldn't put it back down. So therefore, basically, and it kind of comes back to I'm going to say Fran's scenario, but it comes back to how much responsibility does the employee have and how much does the employer have? Can the employer just put in the safety, like in this particular situation, and is that enough? Mm. And therefore, can they successfully defend?
Yeah.
Can they successfully? And as the answer was no, that's not enough by an employer simply to do that, that it's an ongoing responsibility to ensure that you check that the safety, that you instruct, train and supervise, last one being the important one, that you supervise, and that if the defendant should not have stopped at just providing the screen and showing the plaintiff how to put it up and down, but should have also communicated, implemented and supervised the company's policy of keeping the screen down to its employees. So in other words, the onus was quite high, you might argue, depending on which side you're on, to ensure that it's not enough just to say it to somebody, well, you can't, like, so, you know, one looks at a situation where you might have a practice that might grow up that would bypass safety mechanisms within a place of work, and the question that is obviously going to come up there is there a responsibility on the employer to say, well, wait, hold up a second, lads, you know, I provide safety helmets and you're not wearing them, I provide safety equipment and you're not using it.
Yeah.
Can you just fold your arms and go, well, okay, well, I gave it to you, it's up to you to use it, kind of thing? And the answer is no.
Seems a bit unfair on the employer, though, does it?
It's always going to be unfair, depending which way you look at it. But I suppose if you bring in health and safety requirements that say you're supposed to do a risk assessment, that you're supposed to review your risk assessment, that you're supposed to, so far, you know, you're supposed to implement systems, safe systems when you're in a place of work, and you're supposed to supervise and review and ensure they're implemented. That's what the safety requirements are, and that's what they are. And basically, that's the answer, I suppose, that you're going to get to that particular criticism, much though you may not sympathise with it or you may not agree with it. But if you look at the safe system at work, I mean, the other thing that kind of comes up, and people often ask, well, who's got to prove what? You know, if there's a requirement, what does the person taking, the plaintiff, what does the plaintiff have to prove? Well, basically, the plaintiff has to show that the system of work was unsafe. So you have to start by proving that. If you don't prove that it's unsafe, that's the end of the matter. But if you do prove that it's unsafe, then you've got an onus and then switches to the employer to show that they did everything that was reasonably practical in the circumstances to ensure that they complied with the safety standards. So it's not an absolute standard. Do you know what I mean? Mm. It's not absolutely the case that if you have a breach, that that's the end of the matter. You've got to go to the second part of it. But, and I mean, if you look at it, the other issue that often arises, and you often see that comes up, and I remember from my early days in it, there was a kind of a general, that bearing in mind now that the health and safety regime came in 2005, so when I started law, I started way back before 2005, and I remember in the early days when I was involved in litigation, plaintiff litigation primarily, that there was a kind of general feeling out there that it was very hard to successfully take a case where you were involved with animals. And I remember being in the High Court on, you know, one, two occasions. And, you know, there was a general sense that it was very hard to get a case home, would be the kind of colloquial term, where there were animals involved, horses involved. And the one that I think of particularly was, that I was involved in, was a horse case, which we actually settled on the day for relatively small money, because I was arguing with the count barrister that I had, saying, look, I felt that we should have run it to sea, because I felt that there should have been liability, because in that particular case, this was an animal that was known to the owner to be very, very spooky when it came to, you know, riding them out. Mm. And that there was, I had discovered that there was a history that there had been previous falls by riders on it. This was a newly arrived jockey into the stables, put on this horse, not warned, and fell and broke his arm. And I remember we settled it for a very small money, and I was as cross as be damned about it, because I felt, you know, this, I didn't think, I felt that there was a liability there, particularly where there was not on the part of the employer. Mm. But if, interestingly enough, there's been several cases in last year and the year before, literally involving animals. One particular case, for example, which gives you a kind of a feel for this whole concept of system of work and ensuring that your place of work is safe as an employer and the responsibility of it. And the whole area of contributory negligence and how much does the employee contribute or could contribute to it in terms of responsibility for the accident. But there was a case that involved a horse that literally, I don't know what the expression, I think they used exploded when, as in started kicking left, right and centre to the person who was cleaning the horse, and caused fairly serious injuries. And it was found that, and this is the nub of it, was that the employer's defence was that he had done a health and safety check, that he was aware of the fact, and that he'd put in place a sedation protocol. So in other words, that the horse would be sedated. The only problem was that the evidence was, and again, as you know, when you're talking about law, you're always talking about evidence, and that on the face of it would be detrimental to the person's, the plaintiff's case, if you know what I mean. But the evidence that came out was he didn't communicate, either the employer didn't communicate to the employee that he had introduced this protocol of sedation, so therefore didn't succeed. But one would have been, one would have wondered what would have happened if they had. But
when you say it's hard to litigate cases involving animals, why is that? Is that because they're unpredictable nature?
Well, it used to be. Well, the general sense was that, well, an animal is an animal and they're they're unpredictable. I mean, the classic one, another one that I actually had, interestingly enough, that comes to mind, and it came to mind when I was just thinking there, another one that came to mind, which, again, there was a case involving similar circumstances, was that I had a case where, and a lot of the parties are no longer with us. I mean, and I'm not talking about the animal, but it was somebody who was a labourer on a farm, but wasn't a farm labourer. So in other words, just came to do a couple of
jobs
on the farm. And there was a particular cow, if I can try and remember now, but the particular cow had just been dehorned. I think I might be right in the terminology, a while ago now, but I think the cow was recently dehorned, which to anybody in the know apparently would have said that they would be particularly, well, I can just imagine.
Sensitive.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Overly, fairly sensitive, if it would be the right word. And the cattle were being moved from one pen to another through a very narrow gap, and this fellow was there, and he was supposed to make sure that the cow didn't go into that pen, if you know what I mean, and go into this pen. So it was standing blocking one pen, and of course what happened? The cow comes through, sees your man and goes for him. And we took a case, and I remember the time been told again the same thing, you're not going to succeed. And I said, no, but common sense. And I, when you say common sense, when you use that word common sense, I use it in the context of somebody who would have a sense of what the law is about and, like myself, would have experience in law. And I felt that it should be a case that should be litigated, and I would have thought that there should be a responsibility. And interestingly enough, there was in the case that was involved, it was a similar type case. Again, an animal had been led through, etc., into a pen, and this man was blocking off, and he wasn't trained or whatever. But the interesting part of the case was that the action, there was two parties involved, well, there were three parties involved. There was the party who was injured, but there was two other parties that were involved in the case. And one was the person who was buying the cattle, and the other person was the person who was selling the cattle. And all three parties were there on the day, but the evidence was that the person in control of the situation was in fact the owner. Now, it raises two interesting kind of legal issues, in the sense that you've got two different parties, but obviously there's a higher onus on one party than another. So the person who's there, who isn't an employee of, so there's a higher onus on an employer vis-a-vis an employee, but there is also a responsibility by an employer to a non-employee, but there is also a responsibility to somebody who's in control of a situation to ensure safety as well.
Right.
So you have a number of different things at play there. So what happened here was, and I'm only kind of paraphrasing it, but what happened here was the, and again, if you think about it from a practical point of view, the person who owned defended the action. So there was an insurance company involved, one would imagine, and the person who, the other person, i.e. the person who bought the animal, wasn't defending the action. So what comes up there is, what happens when you've got two people in that situation, and what happens in terms of a result? So if you have a situation, and I always remember a case, again, it's funny how these cases come into your mind, but I always remember in my early days, I was only about a year or 2 years qualified, and I was involved in a case in the circuit court where I was acting for a driver and involved in an accident, and I sued the other driver, but there was a third driver involved who was brought in by the second driver. So in other words, you had three parties involved in the litigation, but I only sued one, and the person I sued brought in somebody else and said it was their fault. The judge in the middle of the hearing looked down at me, realising I was a greenhorn, and said that indicated that he was going to find that the responsibility lay with the third driver, not with the one I sued.
So would this be maybe a case where someone is rear-ended who then rear-ends the car in front?
Yeah, rear-ends the car in front. So I think it was a right-hand turn or something.
Okay.
That's what it was. And exactly, and the person was overtaken. And the question was the person making the right-hand turn responsible, or was the overtaken person responsible, if you know what I mean? But my memory, I was 40-some odd years ago now, but my memory of it was that, because it always brings me in mind of the joke that people often tell, and I had it, in fact, in reality, where I was suing some fella. I thought he was old at the time, sure, he was only 60, but he was taking a right-hand turn going into his house down along Boreen in Sligo, and he was in the witness box in the district court, and it was a dangerous driving charge, and I was cross-examining him on behalf of the other fella that was involved in the accident, and I asked him whether he'd put on his indicator, and he says to me, which I was trying to get the answer that they hadn't put on the indicator, and he says, sure, Jesus Christ, doesn't everybody know I go down there? And it brings me in mind, but in this particular case, the judge decided that the person who made the right turn shouldn't have made it, should have pulled in off the road and let the traffic pass. And I never, as a young fella, a young solicitor at the time, I thought, no, taking a right-hand turn, you know, whatever. But because I'd got it wrong. But to make a long story short, the point that I'm making is that when you have a multiplicity of defendants or potential people who may be liable, the question that you might often ask yourself is, why does it become so important? And the reason that it becomes important to even get 1% against one of the parties, if you've got two or more, is that under the Civil Liability Act, which is a piece of legislation, it says that the person with the 1% will carry the full cost of the action, even if it's only 1%. And the person with the 90%, or 99%, because my sums are wrong, but the person with the 99%, so in other words, you can recover again. So if you have multiple parties and one is insured and one's not, one has money and one hasn't, if you can establish 1% liability. So obviously in this particular case, finding responsibility against the owner of the animals was very important if the other party was uninsured. So these are the kind of the mechanics of the litigation that you're talking about.
Yeah.
But again, in that case, found responsibility because there wasn't adequate training by the employee, and that there was a responsibility on the part of the person not. But there was another interesting just case involving. I was saying to you that you can also be responsible for other parties other than employees. And I found this really a very quite an interesting example of it. And I'll finish with you on this if you don't mind. But it was where somebody was painting a house, and in as a contractor painting the house, and the house owners came back into the house, and because of the type of paint that was used, suffered fairly significant kind of personal injuries as a result, and sued the person who did the painting. And the judge found, and this I'll leave you on this one, the judge found liability on the part of the independent contractor that didn't warn the people not to come back into the house.
Wow.
How about that one?
My goodness. All right. Thanks for that, John.
Tip today with Fran Curry.
With Slattery's Garage, puck on. You can't beat experience. With over 50 years maintaining Peugeot cars and vans, we like to call ourselves the experts. Call Slattery's Garage for a free vehicle health check today. 067 24111 or slatterysgarage.ie.